that relationship is in the deep freeze and it's somewhat dysfunctional right now.
The debate continues on Direct Talks with North Korea. It's Wednesday, May 3rd. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Join us online as well at VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, controversial invitations to the White House, growing trees in Laos, China creates a university alliance, restoring a nuclear wasteland, and lemonade from Singapore. We share it all right now on VOA Asia. Despite U.S. President Donald Trump's expressed willingness to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, it seems unlikely to happen anytime soon as neither side is prepared to offer any concessions to warrant such a high-level summit. When Trump on Monday said he would be, quote, honored to meet the North's young leader in an interview with Bloomberg News, he also added the caveat, quote, under the right circumstances, I would meet with him, unquote. White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer later clarified that clearly conditions are not there right now. For a Trump-Kim meeting to happen, some progress toward a North Korean nuclear freeze and a U.S. halt to joint drills would first likely need to be made. But Daniel Pinkston, a Northeast Asia analyst and lecturer in international relations with Troy University in Seoul, says that would take months of intense advanced negotiations between the two sides that have currently severed all lines of official communication.
The president was right when he said under the right conditions, but I don't see those conditions, coming to fruition in a short period of time.
The Trump administration has also yet to put in place an experienced East Asia team in the State Department. Defense Department has not yet named key ambassadors in the region, and that wouldn't be needed to mount such a major diplomatic initiative. And there's also the question of Kim Jong-un's relationship with Chinese President Xi Jinping. His father, Kim Jong-il, often visited Beijing and maintained close relations with the Chinese leadership. But as Daniel Pinkston points out, the young North Korean leader has yet to visit his closest ally and key economic supporter.
That relationship is in the deep freeze, and it's somewhat dysfunctional right now.
Analysts say she will not meet with Kim until the North Korean leader agrees to nuclear disarmament talks, and Kim cannot meet with another world leader for fear of further alienating the Chinese leadership. Joel Witt is a senior fellow at the U.S.-Korea Institute at SAIS and a senior research fellow at Columbia University. As he was waiting to board a plane, he spoke with VOA's Ira Melman about the Trump administration's, quote, unelegant approach to North Korea.
This is not complicated. It's coercive diplomacy 101, and that means that you talk tough, you take steps to put pressure on the other side, but at the same time, you give them an escape route to move down if they decide that talking is in their interest. So putting those components together, that's what all this means. He's talking tough, he's making threats, but at the same time, he's saying, but, you know, we can talk about this and try to find a peaceful way out of this confrontation. So that's not a bad way of going about it.
So you're in favor of how this is being played out so far from the Oval Office?
Behind the rhetoric, behind the missteps, you can see that there is clearly a strategy here. And I don't know if it's going to work, but at least the administration is trying. And quite frankly, I'm not a big supporter of President Trump, but I got to give them credit on this, that at least they're taking it seriously, they're trying. And they're probably not going about it the right way. But you can see a strategy here that is clearly different from the Obama administration's strategy.
How dangerous does the situation look to you to be standing right now?
Well, I think the situation is not nearly as dangerous as everyone's portraying it, including the media. I think that it is true that North Korea could start testing a ballistic missile that can reach the West Coast sometime this year, but that means just testing it. They're not going to deploy it, and we don't even know if that's going to happen or not. So, you know, the threat is there. We need to do something about it, but it's not a threat that's going to emerge in the next day or month or even year. But I think what is going on fits very nicely into the administration's strategy, which is they're elevating the attention given to this issue publicly, and that reflects their own attention. And I think that's very important because in the past, people really haven't been paying attention to this issue.
As he was waiting for a plane, Joel Witt, senior fellow at the U.S.-Korea Institute at SAIS and senior research fellow at Columbia University. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOANews.com. Trump-Kim summit would likely require major concessions. Trump's tax cut plan triggers worries in China. Pakistani and Afghan spy masters hold rare talks. Indian IT company to add 10,000 U.S. jobs. Rights group slams draconian Bangladesh internet laws. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more on Facebook at VOA Asia and on our VOANews.com website. VOA Asia continues. The Trump administration is defending a raft of invitations to meet with controversial regional leaders, including invitations to Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte and Thai Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha to visit the White House. It's part of President Donald Trump's overtures to Southeast Asian leaders as Washington's diplomacy in Asia continues to focus on China and tensions with North Korea. The White House defended Trump's move, saying close relationships with regional leaders are important in gaining consensus against North Korea's nuclear ambitions. Sean Spicer is the White House press secretary.
I think it is an opportunity for us to work with countries in that region that can help play a role in diplomatically and economically isolating North Korea. And frankly, the national interest of the United States, the safety of our people and the safety of people in the region are the number one priorities of the president.
Human rights groups have criticized Thai Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha for seizing power in a coup and curbing democratic rights, while Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte is condemned for his deadly war on drugs. And most recently, Trump has called North Korea a menace that he hopes to eliminate with the help of China. So when Trump called the North Korean leader, quote, a smart cookie, Kim Jong-un must have been flattered.
In American media and culture, Kim Jong-un is often portrayed as a kind of cartoon character. And this kind of respectful display from Trump is probably a shock to the system in North Korea. I'd be fascinated to know how they're processing it, but I don't think they've heard any president say positive things about North Korea or their leaders for a long, long, long time, if ever.
That's Robert Manning, senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. He spoke to VOA via Skype and says Duterte is a significant player in the region, and it's in the U.S. interest to repair ties, although it may not be easy.
I know that, frankly, Duterte personally has a visceral dislike of the United States. I think some of it goes back to our checkered past when we were the colonial power there.
But Manning also notes that the Philippine leader would be no help in checking North Korea.
North Korea issue has been a vexing issue for four presidents. There's no good options, and it's not obvious to me that there's any solution as long as this regime is in power in Pyongyang.
Manning says Trump's long-term policy in the East Asia-Pacific region is not clear, and that his overtures to some of its controversial leaders may be in preparation for a series of regional summits that he's scheduled to attend. Our thanks to VOA's Slotika Hoke for bringing us this report. You're listening to VOA Asia. Happening now in Asia, China issued tighter rules for online news portals and network providers, the latest step in President Xi Jinping's push to secure the internet and maintain strict party control over content. The new regulations extend restrictions on what news can be produced and distributed online by platforms. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're We're glad that you're with us today on VOA Asia. Thanks so much for taking some time out to spend time with us. The Lao government is spending some time as they plan to plant a massive reforestation project that to nearly double the country's forest density. VOA Laos Service reporter Vuaswan Simla spoke with VOA Steve Miller about the initiative, and he began their conversation by asking why the government undertook this program.
The government recognized that the environmental reservation in Laos right now is not in a good shape. They want to increase the density of the forest to the level of the forest density during the years 1960s.
So why did the forest density level drop between 2017 and say that like the 1960s?
Because of the economic development, loggings and slash and burns operation, illegal loggings.
Are those activities still taking place today? Because if the government is going to spend time and money and resources to double the forest density, mm-hmm. are they also addressing the problems that led them to this?
Yes, they are addressing this problem now. The new new prime minister take very serious approach to limit the illegal logging. Of course, it's still going on, but very difficult.
Well, the Lao government is announcing this goal for 40 to 70% increase of forest density.
Yes.
This is not a new program.
Yeah. In fact, it's this one from 2005, but faced various obstacles or challenges. The most important thing here, the new prime minister, that's people are excited about. Because new prime minister, after this person come to the power, people just so kind of like look forward so many changes.
What is it about the new prime minister that has so many people excited about programs like this?
Because as soon as he got into power, he issued an executive order to no more log exporting logs. If everything must be in furniture and so on. And one thing is change in legislation. Second thing, change in enforcement. Regarding the forestry preservation or conservation. And he has done many things in that direction. The highlight of his new government is the logging. That's the first thing he did.
Vuaswan Simla, thank you so much for coming on down here. You are a reporter with our Laos service. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
One of the main designated areas for increasing the forest density is Saravan Province. The land area for growing new trees will be 2,500 hectares, while the land area for reforestation is planned to reach more than 20,000 hectares this year.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
This news alert from VOA Asia. President Donald Trump's proposal for a massive corporate tax cut has sparked a sharp rebuke from Chinese officials, some voicing concern that the move could trigger a tax war and prompt companies to pull out of China. Analysts are skeptical the move could trigger a tax cut race. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. As we continue now with VOA Asia, China has organized an alliance of Asian universities which will pool resources to enhance their capabilities and counter the challenges they face from Western educational institutions, which draw away many of the best students and teachers from Asia. For China, it's also an attempt to grab the leadership position in different aspects of Asian life and enhance its own international standing. China achieved a similar feat in banking when it led over 60 countries in the formation of Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank in 2014. Beijing is now seeking support from dozens of different countries for its Belt and Road program. The new organization, Asian Universities Alliance, was launched in Beijing at the elite Tsinghua University, which was elected to chair the group of 15 universities from a dozen countries. In addition to Tsinghua, the alliance partners include the Peking University in Beijing, University of Tokyo, Hong Kong University of Science and Technology, Singapore National University, Seoul National University, the Indian Institute of Technology, University of Yangon, the University of Colombo, and the Chulalongkorn University of Thailand. Tan Eng Chai, Deputy President and Provost of the National University of Singapore.
A lot of alliance, you have a good mix of Western and Eastern, but I think it's high time for Asia to have our own alliance.
At least two participants who attended the first board meeting of the AUA confirmed that Tsinghua University has offered to fund the new organization with $1.5 million. That's far above the $5,000 contribution other participants are paying as membership fees at present. The core objective for many Asian schools is to rise in the world rankings of universities, which is largely dominated by Western institutions. Tan Eng Chai says high rankings are essential to attracting research funds from industry and international organizations, besides drawing in the best teachers and students from across the globe.
A ranking is invariably based more on research, because if you look at educational outcomes, it's harder to gauge. And if you pour in a lot of money into research, then I think you will go up quite quickly.
He emphasized the government should play a key role in funding research. Only 5% of the research have immediate applications, and industry may not be eager to support the remaining 95%, he says. It's this attempt to pool in research capabilities and bring about a greater exchange of students and teachers that motivated several Asian universities to join the alliance. Prasanna M. Munjumdar is deputy director of IIT Bombay.
What we would look for is strong research groups to be built up across these universities. If we have strength of two universities together, the best of minds from both sides, both obviously have their own niche to contribute. And then, bid for research proposals. This forum will really allow us to also refocus with the Asian universities even more. We can enhance that on various kinds. I think student mobility, faculty exchange, and joint research.
That research could benefit China, which is trying to reduce its reliance on Western sources for advanced technology and is now looking at Asian universities to fill some of its technology gaps. Our thanks to Saibal Dasgupta in Beijing for researching and sending us this story. Developing at this hour in Asia, India-based technology company Infosys says it will create 10,000 jobs in the United States, growing its American footprint at a time when it has become a political target in the United States. Infosys has been a big user of H-1B visas under recent scrutiny by the Trump administration. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, what do you do with an area that's been hit by a nuclear disaster? Japan is still grappling with the effects of a tsunami 6 years ago that compromised the Fukushima nuclear power plant. Before that, there was the world's worst nuclear accident 31 years ago when the Ukrainian city of Chernobyl suffered a meltdown at its nuclear power plant. Large swaths of what was then called the Soviet Union were affected. Now, technology is bringing some new hope to that nuclear wasteland. As VOA's Oksana Likostova reports from Kiev, narrated by Steve Reddish, a solar farm is being built that could generate as much energy as two units of the doomed nuclear plant.
When the Ukrainian government came up with an idea to build a solar farm in Chernobyl, there was some doubt as to whether the project would spur the enthusiasm of investors. But more than 50 companies submitted applications to Ukraine's Minister of Ecology.
Today, almost a year after we have started the work, I can announce the first private investment project working in the Chernobyl zone to build a small solar energy plant.
Semerak says the first private investment in the Chernobyl solar farm is about $1.1 million, enough to build a power plant with the capacity of 1.5 megawatts. The investor, a Ukrainian-German company, has already implemented similar projects in Belarus regions, which had suffered from the Chernobyl disaster.
The appearance of the first, albeit small, power plant evidences that the project is alive and may be followed by powerful investors who are more inert and less mobile.
Domestic and foreign companies, small companies, and energy giants are among those who have expressed interest in constructing the solar farm in the exclusion zone. When it is built out, the solar park is expected to produce half the power that was produced by Chernobyl's nuclear plant after it went online 40 years ago.
We have received over 50 applications from companies of various sizes. Cumulatively, those would be enough to produce 2.5 gigawatts of power, which would be 2,500 megawatts. This is comparable to the output by two units of a nuclear power plant. This is about half the capacity which the Chernobyl power plant had before the disaster.
Semerak says the Chernobyl zone has attracted investors because of its vast land resources and economic incentives. The government recently lowered the cost of rent and streamlined renting procedures. Another powerful driver for investors is the availability of infrastructure, the power grids, which serviced the Chernobyl power plant prior to the nuclear disaster.
In reality, for the last 30 years, the Chernobyl zone has been a black hole for finance of Ukrainian budget and international donors. A lot of money had to be spent to eliminate the consequences of the disaster. We want to change the perception of the Chernobyl zone, the exclusion zone, from the zone of disasters to the area where changes are happening and the development is ongoing. We want to gradually put this area to use.
Construction on the first solar farm should be completed in May of this year. For reporter Oksana Ligostova in Kiev, I'm Steve Reddish, VOA News.
Well, I'm sure you've heard that sugary sodas aren't necessarily great for your health. And that's why there's some new technology for your health that could mimic the taste of sugary drinks without the sugar. As Kevin Enix reports, the technology is being developed in Singapore.
What if that glass of water tasted just like lemonade or soda? The health benefits instantly come to mind, all the flavor of a delicious sugary drink without the health worries.
We realize we can even help for the people who wants to cut down their calorie intake, right? Like if I'm craving for a lemonade, but if we can have a virtual lemonade, we can get the same experience, but zero calorie.
Here's how it works. Put a sensor wand into a glass of lemonade. One set of sensors detect the drink's pH value, its sweetness or sourness. The other senses its color. This information is transmitted to a lemonade simulator. LED lights mimic the color of the drink. The taste is transmitted to the tongue via electric sensors on the mug's rim. In taste tests, the e-lemonade did pretty well.
At the beginning, when I see this electronic thing, right, I was thinking it could be like, I was imagining the electronic taste, but actually it's actually quite real to me. It's so because it's really mild, it's like mild sweet, right? But it's lesser sour than the real lemonade.
The Singaporean researchers are still only working with lemonade, but think the technology will ultimately be applicable with all kinds of drinks. Kevin Enix, VOA News, Washington.
Well, that makes us want to go out and get something to drink now. I'm a little bit thirsty. We thank you for listening to VOA Asia. And while you're out perhaps getting a drink, why don't you let us know what you think about our program? Get in touch with us. There are a number of ways that you can do it. You can contact us via Facebook, our VOA Asia Facebook, ready for you to just send us a message. Our email as well is voaasia@voanews.com. Our director is Tracy Carter, our engineer is Jim Harmon, and our managing editor, Diane Gao. Our VOA Asia team includes Ali Ogden. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead.